This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Jason Turbo, who's the co-author of a book called The Baseball Codes, Beanballs, Sign Stealing, and Bench Clearing Brawls, The Unwritten Rules of America's Pastime. Hi, Jason. How are you?
Good. How are you, David?
Good. I know you're visiting family this weekend, so thanks for taking some time to talk to me. How far are you, by the way, from the Field of Dreams, where you are right now?
It's a good question. I'm in Iowa at the moment, and I come here often. I have never been to the Field of Dreams.
I think you have to go.
I think I have to. I go to the Bob Feller Hall of Fame and Museum pretty much every time I'm out here, but Field of Dreams has so far eluded me.
For me, it's a place that, you know, it has a lot of kind of sentimental value and meaning, so I certainly would want to try to get there. And I think you're not that far from West Branch, where there's also, I remember going there years ago to some kind of place for dinner, which was owned by a former baseball player, where they gave, you know, every time you went there, they would give you like a tiny baseball bat with the guy's name on it.
I love tiny baseball bats.
Oh, you should find this. I'll see if I can find out what it was. He was a completely unknown ex-Yankee, you know, somebody probably from the 1930s who played for 5 minutes or something.
It's okay. A cup of coffee is better than no cup of coffee.
Well, for most kids growing up in America, that the dream would be to be there. It wouldn't matter for how long.
Exactly.
I think. So tell me a little bit about, I guess, kind of what prompted you to write about this particular subject. It's a little esoteric, maybe for, you know, the person who is not necessarily a baseball fan. For people who love baseball, we know about the code. If we've either played it, you know, the codes exist at various levels of ball, probably different in major leagues than anywhere else. But what got you interested in this subject?
Well, like you say, people who follow baseball, even a little, know something about the code. You know, the unwritten rules are essentially the moral code by which players police themselves and each other. And they have to do with respect, above all. I mean, you respect your teammates, respect your opponents, and mostly you respect the game. You know, and as a baseball fan, I knew something about them. As a sports writer, I learned more as a professional sports writer. But my collaborator, Michael Duca, had this idea. You know, we are old colleagues. I used to run a Giants-centric page for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he was one of my freelance writers. And he told me he'd been kicking around this idea of a book about the unwritten rules. And the moment he said it, you know, the light went on in my head. Like, why hadn't anyone done this before? You know, this was a good 5 years ago. Immediately, I prodded him, and we set out together to do this book. We ended up interviewing probably close to 250 players. Being based in the San Francisco Bay Area made that relatively easy because every team comes through one side of the Bay or the other every season. So, you know, tracking down players and ex-players, coaches, and broadcasters and scouts, you know, for a full probably close to two seasons, that's all I did. And, you know, on top of that, I did a ton of research. You know, I read nothing but baseball books for four straight years. I read a ton of magazine and newspaper articles. And then I ended up writing it.
I guess one of the big questions is, how forthcoming were baseball players about some of these things? I mean, obviously they told you the stories, and there are some terrific stories, some of which, you know, I think most fans are familiar with some of the big stories, but you have tons of really interesting stories that happened in the course of a season, you know, might not even have gotten that noticed by the average fan.
One of the things that really appealed to me about this subject is, you know, partly it gets you inside baseball to a degree that, you know, honestly, I don't think any other subject does. It really lets you into kind of the mind of the big league ball player, you know, as he lives and works at the ballpark. But the other appeal to me is that it's a platform to tell great stories, you know, and I'm definitely a sucker for a good baseball story. So that was my goal in pretty much every interview I had. You know, let's get to the stories. Let's get to illustrations of exactly what we're talking about.
Well, and baseball players love to tell stories, but you know, you kind of know that the typical baseball player is taught also not to tell the press the truth of what's really going on. That's part of the code.
That's exactly right. And I definitely encountered that. So it's really interesting, and I didn't put this together until, you know, I was midway into the process, but current players are much more reticent to speak than ex-players. You know, ex-players don't face nearly the backlash, you know, which includes angry pitchers throwing fastballs at them, that current players do. You know, and also, you know, the media likes to talk to them less. You know, I'm talking to scouts and broadcasters who honestly don't give that many interviews because they're not that in a great demand. But what I really found was that ex-players spoke freely because, and this, you know, this is my own hypothesis, because the code is how they were brought up in baseball. You know, they were brought up learning all this methodology about how to give respect and how to expect respect and how to respond if that respect isn't afforded you. And they, like anyone who pays attention to this, can see that the code is, you know, at the very least, it's fraying at the edges. You know, it's still prevalent, it's still there, but it's not as robust as it once was. And I think these ex-players could see that happening, and talking about it at length is one small way they can kind of battle back against that and talk about how it used to be and you know, hopefully make a mark in how it's perceived in the future. And so, you know, on one level, I got a ton of stories from ex-players, especially coaches, you know, telling me stories about their teams, with which I could then go to current players. And, you know, current players don't want to talk about, you know, big picture philosophical issues like respect. But they're much more happy to talk about, oh, you know, in this game, you know, someone took you out with a barrel slide, and this is how you responded. Run me through what happened. So I got a lot of good stories that way. You know, they'll talk about specifics much more easily than kind of nebulous topics. And, you know, through the whole process, it all ended up coming together pretty nicely.
Well, yeah, I actually found it to be a lot of fun. It's a great book to read. I suspect, obviously, that, you know, people who love baseball will love this book more than people who are either desultory fans or not fans at all. But there are some interesting kind of social and historical issues that the idea of the code and the just what you talked about a minute ago kind of brings up, and that is this idea of social change. That because what's happened in baseball has happened in every other sport, it's happened in society. That the idea of a code, actually, of behavior, where humans establish moral grounds between them, because things are gray, or, you know, things are gray, it's not always clear, so that the code is a way of building social relationships. And you could actually compare it to the society as a whole, that, you know, the people who look back on the past and say, well, it was better in the past, and, you know, I'm not necessarily always in agreement with that view, but clearly things were different in the past in the way that people related to each other. You know, we live in a fragmented society where people are not engaged in community as much. So maybe the code in baseball kind of is reflective of the code in culture as a whole.
Well, I mean, you definitely are hitting on something there, although, you know, I might even argue that the reverse of that is true. You know, baseball players as a whole were much more fragmented a generation ago and several generations ago. You know, they played largely on the same team for their whole careers, and they essentially didn't mingle with players from the other team.
Right,
That's why this code is necessary.
There I would argue that that actually is reflective of the social change in the culture, that people lived in the same place for a long period of time years ago. Now they are much more, they travel, so we are more homogenous in our groupings. In other words, if you go to if you grew up in a small town in Iowa in 1930, you probably knew everybody, and you would pretty much stick around there for the rest of your life. That's probably less true today than it was then. So it's similar in that way, that if you know in the old days, as we all know, if you know, there are players who stayed. Like Clemente was a pirate. He was only a pirate. You know, many more players stayed with their teams.
Sure, sure. I mean, it's interesting you'll use the small town in Iowa example.
couldn't help it.
Yeah, of course, of course. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And because these players stayed on their teams and didn't really know each other, certainly to the degree that they do now, the code was essential. I mean, you had to have a method to enforce respect. But now that players, you know, jump to different rosters every few years, now that they share agents and, you know, end up going to the same spots in the Bahamas in the off season and playing charity golf tournaments and all these things that bring them together, you know, players literally know people in every dugout.
Right.
And so the overwhelming need to mandate respect through the unwritten rules isn't as strong because players have an inherent like for each other from the get-go.
Well, and it also means that they're less competitive in a certain way that, you know, as you talked about, Ty Cobb obviously being the famous one, but all of those old players knew that they had to succeed at the cost of others, that if they got a hit, it meant the pitcher, you know, that was bad for the pitcher. If they slid in and upended the guy at second base, that was what they were doing to win. And you could argue that the kind of collegiality among players means there's a little bit less of that fire to win at all costs.
Well, I think you might be right on, you know, for the average player, for the baseline guy, you know, the ordinary ball player perhaps doesn't feel quite the urgency to take out his pal at second base as his counterpart a few generations ago might have. You know, but I think the guys at the upper echelons of the game, the guys with the most drive, aren't affected by any of that stuff.
Probably,
you know, yeah. They're going to play hard and all out no matter what.
Although, isn't there also this idea? You know, again, I'm sort of, I think this is something that you bring up, and that is, today, if you are a superstar and you get hit on purpose, it could conceivably cost you millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
It could cost your team, and could cost the town millions of dollars because you're not there and the attendance goes down or whatever.
Absolutely.
So that also affects the way the code operates. There's less, I think, physical harm accepted as part of baseball today than there was 100 years ago.
Well, that physical harm has been legislated out of the game. I mean, the owners were the first people to recognize that they didn't want to lose $1 million investment or a multi-million dollar investment.
Right.
And you know, the umpires have received, you know, varying orders over the years to tighten things up.
Right. I mean, I think in the old days, you know, that also goes to the idea of players as kind of chattel, expendable, you know, that if even the great stars, you know, no, they didn't get taken care of the way they are today. And I think maybe, you know, again, this is not to judge, but I think, you know, in some ways it's better that players have more respect from their teams in that way and from the rules of the game so they don't get injured because that doesn't do anybody any good.
Yeah, no, you're right. And you know, it brings into all the more stark relief the need to respond, you know, somehow on the field, be it a brushback pitch or a knockdown or hitting a batter or something else. You know, it makes it all the more interesting when a superstar gets drilled, what his team is going to do.
Right, and then, you know, you got the stuff with Rodriguez is a pretty good example, you know, where I remember that game. Remember where he, I think he was running down the first baseline and he kind of got a little too involved in the play in preventing the first baseman from catching the ball.
Are you talking about where he slapped the ball out of Bronson Arroyo's glove?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, went over the line, and suddenly you realize that, you know, the line is still there.
The line is definitely still there, and A-Rod is reminding us of that all the time. You know,
right.
for those of us on the other side of the line, or at least, you know, who are emotionally on the other side of the line, you know, he is finding new ways to point out that line and remind us that he's on the wrong side of it.
Well, you have, you know, you brought in stories about some of the older players, and of course, there was a lot in there about Billy Martin, who was also over the line most of the time. But one of the stories that I thought was truly great and that I had never heard before or read was the Maury Wills, Joe Torre story, where in, I think it was 1964, Torre figured out that Maury Wills, great base dealer, you know, was just incredibly successful at stealing bases. Torre's playing first base. He realizes that by bending down his leg when Wills has got a lead, that he can keep Wills off away from the bag.
that's when Wills is diving back in head first.
Right. So Wills, of course, figures out, this is not going to go. I'm not going to let this happen. He thinks about Ty Cobb. He goes back and he buys a file and sharpens his spikes. But I love this idea that he first showed Tori that he was doing this, not by sliding in feet first and stabbing him with his cleats, but by going over him and stabbing the bag. And so Tori sees right away, these cleats are dangerous. And eventually, he does, in fact, spike Tori, and Tori understands that it's okay.
Even before he spiked him, it became a guessing game. You know, Tori had to figure out, is he coming in head first or feet first, and am I going to, lay my knee down to block the bag, at risk of getting spiked? And it became this own little private competition. And when Wills eventually got him, and he got him good, Tori needed to be stitched up, and Wills was worried to death that he was about to get his head handed to him, because Tori was a much bigger guy. And the Dodgers dugout was all the way across the diamond. Tori wasn't angry. He knew that it had been a game between them, and he had lost that round. And he gave Wills the respect for trying.
Right. I thought that was very symbolic to me, that that the players are really, you're playing to win, but you use this code as a way of establishing a kind of boundary, a set of ground rules. And again, it's a social, it's a kind of human social behavior form that's really interesting. And of course, it changes over time, as we've talked about. And also, there are disagreements among the players at any given time over where the boundary is. So the code is a kind of self-policing, self-creating mechanism, because it reflects the people, only those people who are in the major leagues at that time. And of course, as you have the older generation managers who grew up as players learning it the old way, they gradually die off, replaced by new ones. You've got now a kind of a couple of generations away from the most vivid personalities of the earlier era. It is probably really different, but it's still there.
Well, it is, and even the old school managers today understand it's a different ball game. You look at a couple weeks ago, Brandon Phillips scored a run and pounded his chest on the way back to the dugout. And he wasn't pointing at any of the, this was against the Nationals. He wasn't pointing at the Washington dugout. He wasn't looking at a Washington player. He was looking right at his own teammates, pounding his chest and, self-congratulation, whatever it was. And he got drilled for it the next time up. And a lot of people thought that was out of line, just because he wasn't actually showing up to the Nationals, but he was being demonstrative on the field.
Right, and they were telling him, you've gone too far.
Exactly. And people went, of course, to Dusty Baker, his manager, saying, what do you think about this? And Dusty's like, a generation ago, there's no question you would have gotten drilled, and nobody would have asked me questions about whether it was appropriate or not. But a lot of the old school managers, Dusty included, understand that it is a different game. And, they're not going to demand the same degree of code adherence from their players as they themselves once played with.
No, it's true. I think of Jabba Chamberlain. You see him after striking out a guy doing that kind of basketball roar. And, like basketball players are very demonstrative, and it's really moved into baseball. That never would have happened, even 10 years ago.
Now, there are occasional examples of that, usually with relief pitchers. Going a little nutty. Dennis Eckersley would have his six shooters, and there were guys before him as well.
Were hitters in certain cases where, if Joe Carter hitting a home run in the World Series to win the game, win the World Series, you're allowed to jump up in the air and run around the bases at the seventh game of the World Series, last inning, winning the game. That probably would never have been objected to, although I bet. If you see the pictures of 1956 Don Larson and Yogi Berra, they were celebrating, but that was after the game was won.
Yeah, exactly. Had Brandon Phillips pounded his chest after he scored the winning run or even the go-ahead run in, like, the ninth inning, you know, had it been the top half of the inning.
Yeah, completely different.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I think his run made it 5-1, if I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of leeway for those guys whose heroics are proving instrumental in a victory.
So, having done this book, have you had a lot of response from either players or people involved in the game sort of, either happy about what you've said or talked, written about here or not?
I have yet to meet a player who has read the book, largely because baseball players as a whole don't read that many books.
I know. I think I saw the number of college degrees among baseball players. What is it, 625 players?
That's funny, because I actually wrote that story for the Wall Street Journal.
What is it, 18?
I don't remember what they are. This is months ago.
But it's some really tiny number.
Yeah, it's tiny. That's not to say guys who don't have college educations don't like to read, but, you know, they come straight out of high school and are immediately imbued into this culture of not reading, and so it happens. But we've definitely heard from people, you know, in the management suites and executive suites, who are very happy about the book and have said on any number of levels that it's absolutely right on. The interesting part is it's a fluid thing, this baseball code. And, I'm sure in another few years it will have changed even more than it has between the short time the book came out and right now.
Well, the nice thing about the way things work today is you can record the web enables you to record and add on to a book, which, you know, is kind of stuck between its covers, but you can always keep writing and keep adding to the story.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, that's what I've been doing. You know, I've kept up a blog at baseballcodes.com, more or less documenting, hopefully, everything that happens. It's code-related, not everything, but, you know, the more major things. And I was a little bit surprised. You know, I spent close to 5 years researching the book, you know, looking back through history, while I wasn't paying close attention to day-to-day events, you know, during the years I was researching it. You know, if something big came up, I paid attention, but not the minutiae. And now that I'm paying close attention to what goes on in the big leagues every single day, it's amazing that there's always something to write about. There is some code violation or some response to a code violation all over baseball, all the time.
Right, and it's an amazing thought, actually, that so that's been going on for over 100 years. The number of just sort of day-to-day events that have occurred, it must be in the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, I mean, granted, we didn't have 24-hour news cycles before a few years back, and it wasn't covered in the 1930s or 40s or 50s or 60s quite like it is now. But it's there, man, and it's interesting. And, you know, even the little stuff, even the stuff that doesn't really make a blip on the national radar. You know, in today's blog post, I talked about unwritten rules for general managers, you know, such as stashing a guy on the disabled list when you don't want to send him to the minors for various reasons.
Yeah.
Which is against the actual rules, but it's done.
Done all the time. I think, isn't it, Oliver Perez might be.
Oliver Perez was mentioned. There's a reliever on the Dodgers who was mentioned, who was sent to the DL for what he claims are non-existent reasons, because right. He was a Rule 5 draft pick, and the Dodgers didn't want to send him right. to Philadelphia, or at least that's the alleged story.
Well, that sort of goes to one of the sections of the book, which is about cheating, and that is that, you know, cheating is part of the game. There are limits as long as you can get away with it, and then when you get caught, you got to stop.
Yeah, more or less that's true.
And, you know, because it's a... you're just always trying to get an edge on the other guy, and there's all this... so much gray area in baseball, not just not just for the players, but as you say, for management and general.
Sure. I mean, for example, we hear about someone, you know, getting in trouble for stealing signs from second base. What, a couple times a season, a few times a season, if that? You think that happens only a few times a season? That happens every day. And almost, you know, 95% of the time, the team whose signs are being stolen doesn't make a stink. They just change their sign.
Right. Oh, I loved that part of the book, which was particularly the idea. I can't remember which year it was, but there was I think it was the White Sox were stealing signs just incredibly complexly and doing it forever, and the Giants as well. You had I think it was, you were talking about the Giants stealing signs for just years.
Yeah, and I mean that's different though. That's not from the field of play, and that's where this particular unwritten rule, the divider is. If you start stealing with binoculars from beyond the field of play, that's verboten. I mean, no one's going to tolerate that for long after they find out, especially if you don't stop it. I mean, earlier this year, the Phillies bullpen coach was pointing at the batter, at the opposing catcher with a pair of binoculars, and he got called out. I think it was against the Rockies. And justifiably. I mean, the Rockies would never go to the press with complaints that a Phillies base runner was looking at the catcher signs.
But right. No, that was because of the systemic stealing of signs, essentially a team organized. No, I agree. There's a differentiation between players stealing signs, although I think that's very common. It's part of the cat and mouse. One team is always trying to get the other team's signs.
You get an edge, absolutely.
Sure,
and you know, if you're stealing my signs, it just means I need better signs. That's not on you. I can't blame you for that. But you're right. Back in the 50s, the White Sox had their giant exploding scoreboard, and they had a light among the array of lights that could only be seen from the plate and the home dugout. And they had someone in the scoreboard stealing signs, and that light would flash, accordingly, depending on what the pitch call was.
Right, and they got away with that for a really long time.
Absolutely, they did. And the Giants did the same thing in the old Polo Grounds when their clubhouse was in center field, with windows looking directly toward the catcher. They had a buzzer that flashed into the bullpen, and then the bullpen would signal the hitter. What the Giants might not have realized was the visiting dugout was right next to the visiting clubhouse was right next to the home clubhouse, and they had the exact same view into the catcher. And so opposing teams would also set up with binoculars, and they obviously didn't have a buzzer, but they would find ways to signal the batter.
Right, a towel over, shake a towel or whatever.
Right, I think it was, I want to say Don Zimmer, but I think it might have been someone else, a member of the Cubs who had a big can of peach nectar, and he would just slide that thing from one side of the windowsill to the other, and the batters knew, depending on what side of the windowsill that can was, what kind of pitch was coming up. So it happened across baseball, although it was never really tolerated.
Right. I think that this is the book is full of great stories, and I really appreciate you taking some time to talk to me. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Jason Turbo, who's the co-author with Michael Duca of The Baseball Codes, Beanball, Sign Stealing, and Bench Clearing Brawls, The Unwritten Rules of America's Pastime. And I'm really glad to talk to you, Jason. Thank you.
David, it was a great conversation. Thanks so much.